Nailed it, man. Nailed the intro.
I stuck that landing.
Yeah,
didn't I?
You did. The gold medal achievement there.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, how was your week, man?
My week was fine. I spent a couple of days cat proofing the yard.
Yeah. Were you successful?
Apparently, I was because they are staying inside. Although I feel like that they are probing it like bank robbers who live in the woods.
Yeah. Yeah. Cats are crafty like that, man. I was on vacation, so I had a few days off. I was stoked. Went down to Austin. Very fun, but went to a concert. I had to wear earplugs. I'm getting too old. I couldn't do the rock concerts anymore. It was awful.
I don't think I've ever been to a concert that was loud enough where I felt like I needed earplugs.
I think my ears are just damaged. You know, I used to be in a punk band. I was a drummer, and so my ears are just trashed.
Oh, I remember you told me that.
Yeah, we were terrible. I was not. Like, we didn't record anything.
Are there any punk bands that are good?
I mean, I don't know. You know? I know. We were terrible for a punk band, so I think that we were bottom of the rung of musicians. But it was a lot of fun, but, man, my ears are just trashed. Yeah, it was too much. But I think that's just getting old.
I understand. Well,
sucks.
Yeah, well, I tried to damage my eardrums a couple times, too, you know, because when you're diving and you hit the water with the side of your head, you know, then it creates a percussion there. So,
yeah, when you used to do the diving, were you like a show diver, or did you like Olympic level competitions? Or,
well, I was very far away from Olympic level, but I was a competitive diver.
Yeah,
and I did do shows. So that's what a lot of the high school divers end up doing, is they go into show diving, which looks impressive, but it wouldn't win any medals.
Fair.
And but interestingly, I have noticed that I think that they're going to have high diving in the Olympics.
Oh yeah.
And they opened like the world's largest high diving training center in China. And there's a lot of the world's high divers are going over there, so they've had competitions for many years, like real high diving competitions. But it's just always been a thing among high divers, really.
Yeah.
And now it's going to be a real sport. So
I don't think I've ever seen like a springboard show, but we watched them do the cliff diving in Acapulco.
Right.
It's like real famous. You go to the restaurant and they dive off the deal. I don't know if that's impressive or not, but it seems scary to me. They were diving in between the rocks. So
yeah, well, that one is really good because you have to time it with the swells.
Oh yeah.
Because if you go off when the water's at a low point, then you know that would be more dangerous. But the height of the Acapulco dives is not they're at a height now that's well above that.
Really?
For the competition high diving.
Well, you won't catch me doing that anytime soon.
So, you know, along the lines of stupid stories, when I went down to I worked at a place called Marineland in St. Augustine, Florida. And at that time, I was a show diver, but I was not a high diver. And I met a girl there, and she had a day off, and I wanted to go with her to another park on a date. And I was told that I couldn't because the high diver had that day off or something, and it didn't work out with scheduling. So I said, well, what if I high dive? Then we could switch, right? And they said, well, you know, yeah, of course, if you can high dive, then, you know, we can make the schedule work.
Yeah.
So me being the dummy that I am, I just climbed straight up to the top, and I landed almost flat on my back from about 100 feet. And not only was that incredibly dangerous, like I really could have had internal injuries, but I laid in the pool for quite a while. And when I got out, I said, it's okay. I think I'll be okay without the day off. And my teammates, though, were so impressed by my stupidity and probably my survival that they rearranged the schedule and gave me the day off. And then after that, I learned the right way, which is you're supposed to go incrementally until you figure it out. The timing and everything right.
Man, well, if you're going to be stupid, you better be tough. So.
Yeah, I was tough enough to survive, but not stupid enough not to try it. So.
Fair enough. I'm Scott Hess, tax and business consultant.
I'm John Barton, small business owner. Remember the tortoise and the hare? Slow and steady wins the race.
We started Turtlesmith to help people start small businesses, providing information and resources to small business owners and entrepreneurs.
Build a solid foundation and forge your dreams.
All right, well, this week's segment is step three of phase one of our How to Start Your Own Business, and it is market research. And the end goal of this step is to answer the question, yes or no, is there a potential market for my product or service? So we want to learn how to define a market size and determine kind of the demographics and location of your potential customers. So the first thing you have to do is just sort of define what your market size is. And the way we do that is in a couple different ways, but really we just want to ask the question at the beginning, what is the total number of people who may or may not purchase my product or service? And is it for everyone? Or are you just kind of targeting large companies or consumers? You know, who's your ideal customer? For me, you know, my ideal customer is a small business owner who needs help with bookkeeping, but isn't big enough yet to really need a full-time like accountant working for him. So I kind of have that little niche of catching people on the come up. Your business, though, is kind of just all pool players, right?
Yeah, it's mostly, you know, competitive pool players, people who are a little bit fanatical about it, and, you know, gearheads, people who want the always looking for the best gear.
Yeah. So after we kind of figure out what our market is sort of going to be, we need to kind of learn the definition of supply and demand, which I'm sure you've heard a bunch. It's a term that gets thrown around a lot, and I think it's pretty well defined and most people understand it, but really it's just, you know, how much demand is there for your product and does the current supply meet it? So if there's a hole, you know, you can fill that or whatever. Yeah. I think it's real important too. We have in here to talk about realistic expectations as well. I don't know if you've ever heard people say, you know, I'm going to get into this industry and it's $200 billion industry, and if I can only get 5% of the industry, then I'm going to be a billionaire, you know? It's just kind of foolish to think about it that way. So you do want to determine your total market size, and you do want to see if that market is growing or shrinking or how it's going, and it shouldn't deter you. You know, even if you're in a shrinking industry, it may still be a fine business. You just need to be aware of it. So that's the goal of this kind of step, is just to learn a little more. The next thing that we want to do is kind of define that ideal person demographically. So what is your ideal customer and why? You know, age, male or female? Is it a niche group? Is it certain businesses? You have to define your demographics. So again, for me, it's that, you know, small business owner, the age doesn't matter about male or female. My company really just services a particular size of company. And your company probably, is it mostly male, or is there a mix between male and female, or age range, or do you notice a difference?
I would say that ours is probably male or female, but it's going to be more of a middle-aged, more of a, say, middle-income bracket. You know, we do have customers who save up for our product, but a lot of the purchases with us are more impulse buys, and they do tend to trend towards the middle and upper middle class.
Gotcha. Well, and then that's sort of a big part of that demographic too. What kind of income range are you trying to get at? So, you know, if your product is cheap, does it service, you know, lower class or middle class, or are you trying to target the top 1%? So that's important to think about as well. The next kind of thought that you think about when you're looking at your ideal customer is the geographic. So my business is mostly Oklahoma. I have a couple clients that are outside of Oklahoma that I got through referrals or family friends or stuff like that. But almost all of my clients are in the Oklahoma City metro or the greater Oklahoma area. I don't have very many outside the state. And that's pretty typical for a accounting firm. People who sell online, though, like your business, you're probably worldwide. I bet you ship everywhere.
We do ship everywhere, but our primary market is the American market. that's where most of the tournament play is happening week after week. Also logistically, it's easiest for the customers to reach us here. Time zone differences and stuff like that are not so much at play. So yeah, but we do ship worldwide.
Well, so using that demographic and the geographic kind of factors in identifying who your ideal customer may be, there's a lot of programs which we'll link on our website, Turtlesmith. There's a lot of places you can Google and stuff like that to kind of narrow down a general number, you know, of how many people that may be potential customers and what that market size looks like. And so that's sort of the first step. The next step that you want to get into is looking at who's in the market already. So who are your big competitors? And that's another one that Google's going to be kind of invaluable for. You can just search, look around, try to find everybody who's doing kind of the same thing you're doing. And maybe you started your own brand new business and you have a product that's unlike anything, so there's no competitors. But that's mostly unrealistic for most companies.
But you should also be looking at who can come in if you do happen to have something that's innovative or you have an advancement in the field. Then how quickly can the people that are already in the field catch up to you?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
So be prepared for that because you will be copied.
So in this step two, we also want to take kind of a deep dive into our competitors if possible. So if we're selling a comparable product or if we're replacing a product or if we have a service that's very similar, we want to find out how many competitors there are in our market area. So for me, for example, there are three accounting firms basically within a stone's throw away. Throughout Oklahoma City Metro, there's a few hundred different companies. In Oklahoma in total, there's probably 1,000 different accountants and bookkeeping services and stuff like that. So you want to identify who those people are, but then also you can oftentimes find out how much they're charging and why people like their products. So reading their reviews and seeing why people are attracted to that company over somebody else's. And then also, yeah, seeing how much they charge, what services they offer, things like that.
So question, is it okay to call them and try to suss that information out from them?
I think 100%. Absolutely. In fact, you should even place an order if it's a product. You know, if you're selling, for example, Luboos is selling shoes that are pretty comparable to some other dance shoes in the community. So you probably ordered a bunch of your competitors' products, didn't you?
We did. Yeah, we ordered what were considered the best and we took them apart.
Yeah, and that is a absolutely fine thing to do. And you should do it in this step. If you have a product that's comparable, you should be ordering your competitors and look at the packaging. Do you like the packaging? Can you do it better? Do you like their logo? How does it look? How does it look in the box? What's the customer experience like? Because you're the customer buying it. And can you do better?
So in design, that's called imovation. So it's imitation and innovation. So yeah. There's a certain tenet where you don't always have to be first to market. Sometimes if you're second to market and you take what the market leader is doing and you just do a few things better, the product itself doesn't necessarily have to be better. It could be really close. It could be even a little bit worse. But if you're able to tell a better story, for example, figure out a better way to market, to get your product to market, then that can give you an advantage. So that's part of the research that you have to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so now you kind of go back to looking at your market size, you're looking at your competitors, and you go back and look at the market size and you look at the supply and demand. Is there room in the marketplace for you? That's the big question. And you might not be able to answer it exactly, but you should be able to get a good feeling of it, particularly because in the previous step, you became an expert in your industry. So now you should know how much demand there is. And in this step on the market research, now that we've looked at competitors, we should know how much supply there is generally.
So what if it's a pretty crowded field, but you just honestly believe you can do better?
That's fine. In this step, it's not to deter you if there's too much supply. It's really just to understand it. You want to make sure that before going into this, you understand that there's that much competition and that this is a saturated market. So the only way for you to succeed is to do it better. You have to figure out a way to differentiate yourself, and you have to figure out a way to get on top of all these other competitors. So yeah, not a deterrent, just knowledge.
Okay. And better doesn't mean necessarily, like I said, being better. Although, you know, I personally always try to be better with the actual product, but better could be in the eyes of the consumer as good and cheaper.
Absolutely. Yeah. Cheaper or just different in some way, yeah. You know, maybe you're offering is something as simple as a different color or a different style or just something very, you know, tiny that changes that maybe improves the customer experience. So
kind of riffing on the previous episode where we talked about becoming an expert and combining it with market research. If you're able to identify, for example, a product that is really good, you can do it just as good, and you find out that it's very profitable, then you know that there's room there for you to take less profit and charge less. So you're basically, that's the advantage you're offering to the consumer, because you already know that the market leader realizing the maximum profit that they can get out of the market.
Yeah.
So that leaves room for lots of other people to come in. Now, a lot of times, another thing to look at, though, in that situation is you will have people who are building an inferior product, but they're telling a really good story, which, you know, I consider to be tantamount to fraud, but it's not, you know, depending on what it is, it may or may not be. But the point of it is that they're providing a product that they're telling the consumer a story on. They're able to charge less, but because it actually cost them less to build it, they're actually realizing a pretty good profit. So that's not the way that I would go into it, but that is an important thing to consider if you're going into an area, because it is something that is done. It's a valid part of the market. It's something that that entrepreneurs look for as part of their market research. You know, like, where can I come in and not only be second, but be third, fourth, or fifth into the market, but just tell a better story or have a better way to reach people and be competitive that way.
Yeah, that's completely fair. So the next step in our market research is to do what's called a SWOT analysis. Have you ever heard that term before, SWOT analysis?
Not really, no.
It's kind of a managerial, you know, thing or a marketing thing if you took, like, you know, marketing 101 in college or something like that. But it is an important step, and it stands for strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And it is paramount again, I'm going to say this one more time, even though I said it before, it is paramount again to be realistic. You want to be realistic in what your strengths and your weaknesses are and be realistic on maybe some of the opportunities and threats. Sometimes people just put stuff down here that sounds good, and this is really just an exercise for the business owner to learn what they are and to help fill in the gaps. So in your strengths, you're looking for competitive advantages, weaknesses, what do you lack and where might you struggle? Opportunities are what trends or kind of outside factors might help your company and what are some possibilities for the future of your company? And the threats, you know, what could ruin your business? Who could stomp you into the ground? You know, could, like you just said earlier, could a bigger company that you're trying to compete with just bury you and steal your ideas and all that stuff? So it's important to really look at this and be realistic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I face that. I face that pressure every day. This sounds a little bit like I'm tooting my own horn, but, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years now. And at this point in the game, the designs that I have put out on the market are now the most copied designs that exist.
Yeah.
Over a wide range of models. But the thing of it is that the pressure that I face is the most popular models that I sell, there are knockoffs out there. Some of those knockoffs are decent, you know, until you take them apart, you know, they look decent. And so you have to be prepared for that, you know, because you know that whoever the leader is in whatever field it is, you know, I always compare it to just racing, right? On whoever the number one is, everyone else is going for that spot. And they're doing everything they can, if they're dedicated, to take over that spot. and they're going to try to take away as much market share from you as they can.
Yeah.
So part of this, in my opinion, is really, really taking a real hard look at what you're able to do, what you're able to do consistently, and where you can differentiate. Chandler, help me with that. Differentiate. Where you can differentiate yourself. So that might be, for example, even though you have the best product, you might not have the best customer service. You know, a lot of people get kind of arrogant about it when they have a really good product and they think, oh, well, I don't have to. You know, it's kind of like if anybody's ever watched Seinfeld and the soup Nazi episode, no soup for you.
Yeah.
And you know, I'll admit that there have been times, you know, where I've essentially said that to customers. You know, I've said, you know what, I don't want to sell to you. And I fired customers. And that feels good in the moment to be able to do that. There's a level of freedom there. But it's much better if I can work it out with them, you know, and not turn somebody into an enemy of the product and of the brand and of me. And so you might say to yourself, okay, I've got the best product. I've got a pretty healthy profit margin. And instead of taking all of that profit and spending it on, you know, multiple Hawaii vacations every year, why don't I take part of it and spend it on making sure that we're giving awesome customer service that's better than the knockoffs? So, you know, that's something that I think is really important to consider and look at and say, well, is this a weakness, a place where they can come in under me and service the customer better, even though it's an inferior product? They're just making the customer happy. So I need to make the customer just as happy or happier.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Sometimes those strengths will reveal opportunities and then the weaknesses can reveal threats in your business. I think it's also really important not only to do this kind of SWOT analysis with your company and the business that you're trying to build, but also personally. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important for people to do this kind of analysis personally. And so I did one for me, and my strengths in my business and as a person in this kind of field is explaining complex tax issues to people. I've gotten very good at kind of decoding the tax code into just basic terms that people can understand. I'm real good with numbers and then obviously with the critical thinking and problem solving. But my weaknesses, sales and marketing, I'm a disaster. I can never figure out how to properly advertise my business. I am extremely impatient. I want things done quickly and efficiently, and I get pretty frustrated dealing with the IRS and state because they take forever, and also you can get frustrated with clients because a lot of the clients that come in here have problems, and they're often not the best at organizing or getting me the things I need, so it can be kind of become a little bit of a hassle. And another big weakness of mine is I am just way too gullible for a sob story. Too many times clients will be in real hard shape, or, you know, we had a lady in here the other day who was just sobbing about stuff.
A literal sob story.
It literal. She was crying about, you know, she owes a bunch of taxes and she has no idea what she's going to do. And she doesn't have enough money to pay me. And how can I help? And I'm like, well, we'll figure out discounts and stuff. All the while, Tiffany's, you know, giving me the evil eye. Like, stop falling for this nonsense. But it just is what it is. In the opportunities section of this, I get to work with a lot of great people like you. This is a huge opportunity for me, this turtlesmith.com thing that we're working on and all the kind of various projects that are going to go along with it. I've met a lot of other business owners who have given me, you know, great opportunities to invest in companies and be a part of things. And so those are huge opportunities that, you know, my strengths built up by getting a good client base. And then the threats, you know, obviously for my business is competition. Really, the biggest threat for my business is just kind of a loss of credibility. You know, if I lose face in front of my clients, or I make too many little mistakes by not paying attention, people start to not trust you as much. You know, one mistake is okay, but if two or three in a row and you're, you know, because you're not paying attention or you're overworked or have too many clients, you can start losing credibility. And so that's my biggest threat. I don't want to lose credibility with my clients because it takes a lifetime to build a reputation and 2 seconds to ruin it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can tell you from my own experience, you know, when I first got here to Oklahoma, I basically picked an accountant out of the phone book. And that gentleman was incredibly nice, seemed very knowledgeable, put us over to somebody else in his office to help get us straightened out. And 3 years later, I got another $12,000 tax bill because something he did was not filled out correctly. Yeah. So needless to say, I'm no longer with that person.
Yeah. And that's how I get most of my clients. They come in mad at some other accountant, you know? So, the last couple things to talk about is just some of the resources that you can utilize when doing your market research. So government agencies are going to be a great one. The Census Bureau, Labor Statistics, Worldwide Stats. Google is going to be your best friend. You can really find all kinds of information.
I want to add one to that.
Yeah, yeah.
That might not be obvious to people. And it obviously this isn't going to pertain to everyone either, but it pertained to me, and it came about for me one time when I was having a dispute with customs about the classification of something we were importing, and I came across some statistics at the I'm not even sure what agency it was, maybe the customs, you know, agency or whatever, but somewhere in there were some statistics about how much of the item that I was looking for is imported every year. And then along with that was, for example, how many pool tables are imported.
Yeah.
So, you know, with some easy extrapolation, you know, you can kind of get a decent idea of the size of the market by what's being imported, for example, at least that part of it. You know,
that's super clever. I didn't even think about that. That's a clever thought. Yeah, absolutely. Where'd you find those? Do you remember?
Well, I was looking through, I believe, the customs tables, and at some point, I'm not sure if it was if I saw that there was some kind of number of how many are imported, so they have to report on that. I don't know if it was tied with each classification or if there was an overall report, but it's just when I was browsing around. And so basically I would say just look for import data. If your business is one that is in competition with products that are imported, or mm-hmm. you're the one doing the importing and you're kind of looking for a market size, that can be one data point that you can get a hold of that'll give you kind of a rough idea of how big your industry is. You know, fantastic. So if I was going to sell pool tables, for example, I would want to know, for example, the types of tables that were being imported, the prices of them, and then the volume of them, you know, because if I were going to sell tables that were made in America that were generally more expensive, then I would want to know, like, are there 20 times more tables coming in from overseas? That would indicate possibly that those are the ones that are being bought more, much more than the ones I want to sell.
Fair enough. Another thing I want to mention is if you kind of Google market reports on certain industries, there are a ton of websites that sell professionally done market reports. You can get one of those if you really want to, but I've never really seen that they're that worth it at this stage. We're just trying to kind of get a high level view of what the market might be. That kind of gets into the nitty gritty of stuff, and they can be very expensive, you know, $3,000 to $10,000 for those kind of deals. So use those if you really want to, but I don't think that they're super necessary. One kind of tip I will give you, if any of your products or services or anything like that kind of borders on some academic fields, like if you have an engineering product or you do have a finance product or something that helps in the academic world or that has been researched a lot within the academic world, hit up professors. You would be so shocked as to how many professors will actually get back to you. Scholars and academics, they really want to see your stuff. They want to help. And you can also oftentimes get free theses and documents directly from them. They don't want you to go buy it, you know, on some publisher's website that's making a bunch of money. They'll just send you this stuff. So it's kind of
a great tip, actually. You know, that's a great tip. And I think a lot of people don't even realize they can do that.
Absolutely. You just look them up and email them. We've done it a bunch of times for other stuff, and they're really most often happy to help. Now, sometimes you get a grumpy one that tells you to go fuck yourself, but it's just just a deal. You have to, sometimes you just have to deal with it. But like we talked about before, you'd be really shocked about how often people just want to help. So reach out to those people if you can. The next one is industry associations. And if you even feel like, you know, you're better than that, or you know, or you don't want to join the plumbers union, or, you know, you don't want to be a part of your industry associations, you know, that's fine. But the information that you can get from them and the networking opportunities and the kind of camaraderie of doing that stuff is great. There's all kinds of associations for about every job. There are Reddit groups, Discord groups, forums, everything for every job that you could want to do. And joining those or getting information from them or stuff like that is great.
So I'm going to give you a quick personal example of the importance of networking.
Mm-hmm.
So my sprinkler system was acting up, and I Googled sprinkler repair and, you know, found a guy and just called him up, and he had time, so he came out. And he was having trouble, so he called in a friend. Well, it turns out that that friend has a much larger sprinkler business, and the guy that was doing my work worked for him for like 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy came out on his own, didn't charge anything, helped him solve his problem, added to his knowledge base, and went out of his way to recommend him to me even more, you know, so that I would be happy with him. And that's really what I've noticed happens in industry. If you cultivate the relationships with people, then you will find out that you have a good network of people to help. I can't tell you the amount of times when I've had a plumber over and they couldn't figure out a problem and they just call a plumber friend,
yeah,
you know, who will tell them what to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that happens in all kinds of industries. So again, this is another time when you shouldn't be afraid to reach out, you know, hit people up. If you're trying to get into a trade or a specific service or something like that, just talk to some people, make a phone call, ask for advice. The worst thing to say is no. So,
one thing that I've done over the years is I will often send my customers or send interested parties to other case makers.
Oh yeah.
So I'll be talking to them and I'll realize, you know, that we don't make the kind of case they want, you know. Or we could make it, but we don't have time to make it,
mm-hmm,
because we'd have to retool or, you know, create new patterns or something like that. So I will send them to my colleagues that I respect, who I think would do a good job. And I think that goes a long way in the community. So, but you have to have a community to be able to do that and be trusted enough where they trust you enough where when you send them a customer, you know, that they're going to be able to take care of that customer. And the customer then trusts you when he's able to get served.
Fair enough. Well, at the end of this step, we're going to go back to the same question that we asked at the beginning, the end goal. Yes or no, is there a market for my product or service? You started off with an elevator pitch. So you have your kind of razor sharp focus on what your business is going to be. You've become an expert in your industry. And now you should be able to know, this is my market size. This is the potential customers I'm going to be going after. And I think that there's a market for my business. And then you'll move on to the next step.
So I wanted to mention, though, the you didn't quite get to the last piece here, which is like join groups or networks. We talked about networks, but as you had put on here, like Reddit or Discord and things like that. So I wanted to mention from my own personal experience how important some of the groups have been. So for example, I had mentioned that I'm not a leather worker, or I was not a leather worker when I started this. So I found a forum called leatherworkers.net. That forum was invaluable,
mm-hmm,
but I did something else too, is I had a laser engraver and a laser cutter. And a lot of the leather workers at that time didn't use that, and some of them even looked down on it. So I found a woodworkers forum that used, where they had a separate sub forum just for lasers. And, you know, some of the more traditional woodworkers, you know, they'd kind of sneer at the laser guys, but the sub forum, though, full of the laser guys, turned out to be invaluable for me to learn how to use this machine. And all of the things where you couldn't even get that level of support from the manufacturers. And that happens all the time. So in just about every industry these days, you can find an online forum or more than one that will be full of people who have done experiments. They've tried every little thing. They've tested adhesive, some of them formally, some of them informally. And you can get so many tips. And beyond that, you can get tips on, you know, how to sell at shows, best ways to present, how to calculate prices. You know, just every question that you might want to think of to ask, there's lots of people out there who have done it and are willing to share.
And I think that will shock a lot of people of how many experts and industry leaders and just people who are doing the same thing you're doing are willing to share. I feel like everybody thinks everything's so closely guarded, but it's really not. Once you get out there, they're happy to show you.
Absolutely. You know, Stephen Covey, he's one of the authors of the, you know, I call them self-help books, but his kind of a self-help business slash book. One of his tenets is that that there's enough market for everyone, just about. You know, so we obviously know that there's a point where it becomes so saturated, you know, that with so many players in the market, you know, there's not enough really for everyone to make money. But one of the tenets of that he put in the book was that that there is room for everyone most of the time. He said, I think all the time, but I think most of the time, you know, because especially if we're talking about the level of business that we're talking about, small businesses serving, you know, certain niches, you know, if we're talking about, you know, in Oklahoma City, for example, you know, there may be 1,000 plumbers. So if there's 1,001, and all those 1,000 are doing okay, some will be not, you know, some will not be doing great, some will be doing really great. Then if you're the 1,001 plumber, right, then it's really going to be more on you whether you do great than it will be whether the market is too saturated.
That's a fair point. Fair point. Well, anything else to add on the market research?
I don't. I would say that. So just remember, guys, that whenever I say I don't or one last thing, we're going to be here another hour.
Probably.
But no, really, really what I want to say, though, is like I jumped into this with no market research, just a literal emotional, I want to build something for myself. And a guy asked me to build one for him, and it just went on from there. So that's kind of an accidental way to get into business. But what I really should have done is the moment that I said to myself, oh, you know what, this could be a business, that's when I should have gone and done this type of planning and this level of planning, because I spent, you know, a good 10, 15 years stumbling and learning the hard way and, you know, tripping over rocks and landing with my face on hot stoves. And so these are hard lessons that I've learned. And with your guidance, you know, on how to do it right, and my stories, you know, on how to do it wrong, I think that if you guys out there are listening to us, you should make sure that you really, truly follow these steps, because if you have a good idea, it's worth taking the time to invest your time into that idea to make sure that you give yourself the best chance to realize it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This episode is sponsored by JB Cases. JB Cases is a pool cue case company specializing in custom cases. They have been in business since 2007, and their motto is true protection, true durability, true comfort, and true custom. Visit them at jbcases.com.
All right. In this segment, we're going to be talking about tipping and tipflation, which I'm not sure if you have strong opinions about, but it seems to be getting out of hand, and I'm the worst. I'm an over-tipper. I tip everybody. The only place I draw the line is drive-thrus. I refuse.
So I don't know that it's necessarily out of hand, in my opinion, but we did a little bit of research on this, you know, when he said we were going to do the topic, and Chandler helped out on this. So one of the statistics that we found here was that, let's see what we said here. The in February 2020, just before the pandemic began, in food and drink specifically, the share of remote transactions when tipping was offered was 43.4%, according to Square. In February 2023, that's 3 years later, that share had risen 30% to 74.5%.
Yeah, that's wild.
Right. So, but the thing is that, so I know you said it's out of hand, right? But my thing there is that we also have to realize that the frequency of ordering, remote ordering, also increased quite a bit.
All right, let me tell you why I think it's out of hand. I went to, and I'm not going to name the store, but when I was on my vacation down in Austin, I went to this place to buy drinks, just like you grab a drink out of the cooler, right? So we grabbed a couple drinks, we grabbed a couple snacks. We went up to the self-serve kiosk where I scanned all of my stuff in myself, and then it asked me for a tip.
That is ridiculous.
That's out of hand, man.
That is anybody trying to do that definitely is out of hand and ridiculous. Yeah. So I totally agree with that.
Yeah. And then the problem is it's not like no tip's not a button. You have to like find the no tip button because it just pops up 15, 20, 25%. Or sometimes it's 20, 25, 30%, which is ridiculous.
So that's that's actually a good point psychologically. So these companies have realized, you know, and they realized this long before too, when they started printing on the receipts. So when you get a receipt and at a restaurant and it says, you know, 18% is this much, you know, so they do the calculation for you. So that's when they started to learn that the easier they make it to calculate it, the more often someone will choose a higher amount.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So psychologically then, when we started to get into the kiosk method and the handhelds, and the tablets, you know, where they turn the tablet around and hand it to you and let you choose, it becomes much easier to hit a button. So one of these things is like the type of convenience store deal where you went to, where you buy it yourself and everything. It's not even really a tip at that point. It's literally a profit grab that they're asking you for. And so that should not even be allowed, in my opinion, because who are you actually tipping?
Well, then I've heard sometimes too, you got to ask the actual servers on whether they're getting their tips or not, because oftentimes they're not, unless you could tip them in cash.
Yeah, that's actually true. We were at a barbecue restaurant here locally, and I'll never eat there again because of this. You know, they were decent. The food was decent. You know, I would eat there again if I wanted to, but the reason that I won't eat there again is because we were informed that all the tips that come in on credit cards, the owner keeps.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even know if that's completely legal.
I don't know the legality of it exactly. I know that waiters and waitresses have to make like a minimum wage at least, or a certain amount with the tips, which I think you have some notes on that
right,
as well.
Right. Yeah. Chandler found that out, that basically the law now is that the restaurant has to make up the difference between the tipped minimum wage and the federal minimum wage or the state minimum wage, whichever is higher. So the federal law there is basically whichever one benefits the employee more. So if federal minimum wage is $7.25, but state is $9, then if the tipped employee didn't make the equivalent of $9 or more, then the restaurant has to make it up.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not exactly sure how that's even worked out because...
Well, I just know for a fact, actually, that they take it at $2.50 or $3 for the wage, and then they just make sure that tips match a little bit over the minimum.
Well, when I was, I remember correctly, a long time ago when I was working at a couple restaurants, the minimum reporting, as I remember it, was we had to report at least 12% over our gross receipts.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And otherwise, the IRS would come after you.
The IRS rule is any tip that you receive over $20 in a time frame, you have to report. If you
get
under $20, you don't have to report it, but anything over $20, you got to report.
Well, I think the IRS and everybody else knows that tips are not being reported in that frequency.
I would love to actually talk to, you know, I bet only at fancy restaurants, like those guys make a lot of money, you know, the waiters and waitresses at like, you know, 5-star dining or Michelin star dining, you know, that get tipped $500 or something crazy. I bet they have to report all theirs, but the average person's not.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know that they would necessarily report their cash tips either there, you know?
You got to wonder.
So. Don't know, but, you know, I have a thing where lately I've noticed that I'm more likely to tip, like, at a Starbucks drive-through.
Yeah.
Where I never, ever think about tipping at a McDonald's drive-through, for example, and I'm just, like I found myself wondering why. Why does it feel like I should tip someone at a Starbucks for a really overpriced drink? My kids, unfortunately, are addicted to this stuff. So, by the way, people, you know, it is much more lucrative to start a Starbucks than it is to have a crack business. and trust me, they get just as addicted.
Yeah.
Fair
enough.
But by the way, do people tip their crack dealer?
I doubt it. I think at that point you're just scrounging.
Can you imagine
change.
Though? How cool would that be? Right.
Yeah.
You go to your drug dealer and he's like, "Hey, man."
Maybe if he makes deliveries, you know, yeah. I tip my delivery guy. So.
But, you know, it is really interesting. And it also brings up a discussion about, you know, what, so if you're going to get in business, you know, like if you're going to do a sort of a restaurant business or even a delivery business or whatever, this kind of goes back to our previous topic about learning your market.
Mm-hmm.
So if a lot of people I know, you know, do the gig work, they do the Uber Eats and so on and the deliveries. And then oftentimes you'll see complaints about the tipping that they don't get. A lot of times they won't take orders for customers or particular types of orders that they don't want to pick up because they feel like that those types of orders are not going to result in a tip.
Yeah.
And so then the other side of this coin, you know, which is worthy of discussion maybe at another day, is it better? Should we be going towards no tipping? You know, where people are paid, you know, what we would consider to be a proper wage, and we don't have to worry about whether they are making it or not, and we just know that they're being paid a fair wage like any other job.
I mean, theoretically, that's the best way to do it, but tipping is just so ingrained in our culture. I can't see it leaving, and I don't suggest anybody starting a small business or a restaurant or something to, unless your business model is to break that mold, you know, you should probably stick with the industry standards a little bit, but
maybe, well, there are some high-powered people.
Maybe you do want to break the molds, I don't know.
Chandler and I were just reading about this earlier. There's some high-powered people, restaurateurs, that are trying to break the mold, and they've even engendered lawsuits.
Yeah.
Not only lawsuits from servers that claim that they're making less money.
Mm-hmm.
One server apparently is claiming that there's some sort of a conspiracy or kind of an antitrust angle to this to stop tipping.
Yeah.
And as we were reading, this person even got sued from a customer for basically raising prices, you know, causing the customer to have to pay higher prices involuntarily.
Yeah.
You know, and we had talked about this. The tips, average tips are 16%
mm-hmm.
Across the nation. In the particular market that we looked at, the average tips were like 21%. And this restaurateur said that he was basically going to include tips in the prices, and the increase in prices would be 21 to 25%. Well, if the average tips are 21% anyway across that area, and then they do increase it to 25%, which the rationale there was that money would then get split between the non-tipped workers, so the cooks and the busboys and so on, then that's a good rationale from that person's standpoint. From the owner's standpoint, you know, basically spreading it out and keeping everybody happier and making sure everybody's earning a little bit more. But from the consumer standpoint, you know, that's essentially a 5% increase in price across the board.
Yeah, you know, the other one I saw at this restaurant that we ate at while we were down there in Austin, there was like a 4%, maybe it wasn't in Austin. Anyway, some restaurant, it had like a 4.5% hospitality charge. And they said clearly it wasn't a tip. It was just a hospitality
charge.
Those
drive me crazy. The way that they do these loopholes, And Vegas is one.
Yeah.
So I've been going to Vegas for, you know, 25 years doing shows out there. And their thing, which is not new now, I guess they've been doing it, you know, I probably find out they've been doing it a lot longer than I think. But I probably noticed it maybe about 10 years ago, and it's their resort fees.
Yeah.
And that is just, that drives me up a wall. You know, you just want to get a room. You're not going to use their spa or any of this other stuff, but then they find a way to charge you every single day for amenities that you're not even using.
Well, what's your opinion on somebody starting a small business and the industry standard is some of this kind of nickel and dime stuff? In my opinion, I think you shouldn't do it. I think it should be, this is the price, here it is. And I'm even a big fan of having a flat, you know, have a flat price. If it's $50, just have it be $50. You don't have to have it be $49.99. And I know that there's some reasons for it, but that's just my opinion. I get tired of that nonsense. And all these little nickel and dime charges, it just pisses you off.
See, I hate the nickel and dime charges, especially when they're not communicated up front.
Yeah.
Now, I do like a la carte charges. So I like price list. I like it when people say, okay, they can select what they want. So in my business, for example, I just actually got into this discussion on Facebook with a guy yesterday. We were talking about inflation and everything. And he goes, well, why can't I get a $200 case? And I'm not talking about 10 years ago. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, in the past 15 years since we've been doing this, not only have my costs risen for materials and supplies, just the normal rise in cost that happens year after year, but we're also pouring more people hours, you know, more shop hours into the product. So, and we give a lifetime warranty. So, you know, we did raise the prices just a little bit. So now the same case that you could get for $200 5 years ago costs you $225 now. And I asked him, I said, are you really complaining about an extra $25 when you're getting a case of this quality with a lifetime warranty?
Yeah.
But a lot of people don't understand that. You know, they really don't understand what all goes into it. So I like to lay out the prices very clearly. But what that does lead to, at least in my business, it leads to people picking out two cases that look similar, but they're actually not so. They're not the same because they don't have the same amount of features on them. And then they will say, "Well, why is this one $50 cheaper than this one?" And then I have to go in and explain the a la carte and the various things that are on it. So it does require a little bit more education sometimes. So I would say that I agree with you wherever possible. You know, just do flat pricing and easy to understand pricing and pricing without psychological tricks, which is where the nine comes from. But one of the things is, and this is something you can control more as a small business owner, you can control this, but big conglomerates, the big corporations, they have literal research teams, psychologists, psychiatrists on staff. They invest millions of dollars just so that they can increase their revenue per product by 1 or 2 points.
Yeah.
And these, this is basically millions, tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars are lined up against the consumer. And they're figuring out exactly what pushes our buttons.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So my advice is, if you're a small business, like we're talking about, then you be the ante of that. You be the one that's as transparent and as clear as possible, you know, and you don't nickel and dime your customers, and you're going to come out better. People are going to trust you more.
And if you're asking for tips, give them to your employees.
Absolutely, you should give them. I mean, don't steal from your employees and take the tips like that. You know, you hadn't told me about that deal with the convenience store thing. I find that to be reprehensible.
It was the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. So I guess that's why I push back a little bit on the out of hand part, because a lot of people are doing such gig work and stuff, and they're really.
I always tip for those guys. Yeah, I don't mind at all.
Yeah, they're, you know, at the end of the day, they're not really earning a lot. They really do depend on the tips. But yeah, something like that is just. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that was even illegal.
I doubt it is, but you know. So back to the tips on the, what are you tipping? What do you tip at restaurants?
So as a product of the restaurant business, mm-hmm. you know, so I did that a lot when I was younger. I will start out at 15%. Now, yeah. I know standard is generally around 20% these days. You know, it's kind of risen. But I basically start out as I walk in the restaurant, before I've ordered anything, they're getting 15%. And then they can grow from there depending on how good they are. So they do have to earn that extra 5% in my eyes. Now, I lived in Germany for 10 years, and in Europe, there's no tipping. It's you're, you know, waiting as a or serving as a profession. You go to actual school for it. And there's no tipping. Now, I think you told me before, right, that you were
I've never met a European
rock star
that wouldn't take the tip yeah. when I left it. We only got denied once at the fancy French restaurant. The guy was a bit snooty about it, but in Germany and Austria, they loved the tips. Every time we get a beer, you know, it was like €8. I just gave him 10, and I was like, no change.
Most of the time when I was over there, I was pretty poor. So I really locked on to the no tipping
yeah.
because I didn't have the extra money. And then, you know, a lot of my experiences over there were that they would treat it more like a profession. So, you know, I mean, maybe it was because when I lived there, I was not presenting so much as a tourist, you know, I wasn't a visitor so much as someone who lived there. I spoke the language and so on. So maybe they were.
Yeah,
a little bit more, but also I have to be honest that you know, once I knew that that tipping was not a thing over there, I didn't tip.
Yeah, fair enough.
Or I didn't try to.
Well, I am a chronic over tipper. I usually start at 20 or usually 25%, and then sometimes I'll tip up to 30.
Yeah, I'm that way too, especially if I'm celebrating something and then they were particularly nice. You know, Lula will sometimes look at me funny, you know, because we'll have a $50 bill or something, and I might tip him $25.
Yeah.
You know, and she'll be like, why? And I'll be like, because we can afford it, honey. It's okay.
Well, and everybody looks at me crazy, especially in Vegas. In Vegas, just everybody gets money. When you walk in the door, the back guy gets $20, the door guy gets $20. And I always tip the front desk people. Have you ever tried that trick before?
I have a few times, yeah. but not that much.
It always
for
works.
For me, for the shows, it was always important to tip the valet.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, I found out that if I tip the valet on day one, $100, and I just tell them I'm doing the show and just keep my car close, you know, then they do it. And then it works. I never have to tip again for the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, but I usually do. I usually tip them, you know, $10 or something like that when they come out. But they always, they basically communicate it to the other valets. And they treat me like a VIP.
I mean, it's just the move if you got a little extra income. But, you know, some people are struggling, so that tip can really eat into it, into their budget. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's just part of our culture these days. I just don't like it when, like you said, I don't like it when it's used to exploit workers.
Yeah.
Well,
that's why I carry cash around now most of the time. I try to pay most of my meals and all the stuff on my credit card, but then I usually try to tip in cash if I can.
That you know, that's something we should talk about in a future episode is credit cards versus cash and you know, what it means to a business. So I'm not going to get into detail right here, but you know, there is a meme going around, kind of an idea of why you should pay cash and what cash does in a society and how it circulates. As opposed to how it circulates when it's a credit card payment.
Right. Well, fair enough. Any other thoughts on tips? Where does Oklahoma fall in the generous? We're looking at a deal for generous states for tipping.
So God, actually, 37th. You know,
that's not terrible. 19.2%, I guess.
Yeah. Now, what does the top go up to the top with the column stand for? So it's the average tip percentage. Full service restaurant or quick service restaurant. So Delaware is currently the highest at 21% on average and 22.5% for full service, 17.8% for a quick service. And then if you go to Oklahoma, we are actually higher. Well, we're not higher, but we're not that far off. We're 20% on the full service, 16% on the quick service, and our average is 19.2%. I don't know how they get 19.2% out of between 19.9 and 16, but you know, that's math that I can understand.
Well, I think it's a weighted average because there's more full service tipping than there is.
Okay, you're going to have to explain that in accounting terms.
Statistics. That's the most surprising to me is that California is the worst. California, y'all need to step up your tipping game.
No kidding. Clearly. Man. Well, you know, they say it is really expensive to live in California. So.
I guess that's true. I can't judge. I don't live in California, so maybe it's just a nightmare.
But then New York, where's New York at? So, you know, just consider. New York's towards the bottom, too, on 15.5% on the... on the quick service, 19% on the
I guess that makes a little bit of sense. Some of those more, the higher cost of living is lower. But that doesn't quite make too much sense because Louisiana and Texas are pretty low, and Texas isn't that expensive. I guess if you're in Austin, don't go to Austin. It's very expensive.
Well, you know, another thing with that is there's so many factors involved in this too, you know. So what happens if you take Dallas out or of Texas, for example, you know, what would that be?
Fair enough.
Or Austin, for example. You know, Hawaii is near the bottom, and you would think that would be, you know, being such a big tourist destination. Yeah.
Well, I'm of the opinion that the tipping is getting a little out of hand, but I still like tipping. So I'm still going to over tip where I can. But I draw the line at the drive-thrus, like I said. What are your thoughts? Do you think tipping's out of hand, or you think it's... After my story of the convenience store, do you think it's getting a little out of hand?
I think based on that example, yes. Yeah. It people who do that, you know, are fraudulent in my opinion. You know, a store that doesn't, basically it's self-serve. I could imagine there, you know, at Walmart, you know, they're already having you check out on your own. And then imagine if they ask you for a tip on top of that.
You know? Nightmare.
So, but you know what? At the same time that they're doing this stuff, these big corporations and conglomerates, they are actively trying to build robots to replace the servers that are there.
Yeah, that'll have to be another episode where we talk about what the hell is going to happen when all the servers are replaced.
And I promise you that the AI robot that delivers your food is going to want a tip.
You think so? All right. All right. AI tips. They have rights too. Is that the move?
Oh, I promise you they're gonna ask for robot rights.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, any other thoughts on tipflation for today?
No.
All right, man.
This episode is sponsored by JB Cases. JB Cases is a pool cue case company specializing in custom cases. They have been in business since 2007, and their motto is true protection, true durability, true comfort, and true custom. Visit them at jbcases.com.
Well, next thing we're going to talk about, I guess, is the end of our episodes. We always do failures and successes. You got one? Failure or success?
I would say that a success. Was that I listened to you, and I hired an assistant who is now making my life better.
Delegating. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Was that tough to do at the beginning? Very. And man, that's hard, isn't it? Just trusting somebody else to do something that you know you can do better.
Mm-hmm.
But then you find out they do it pretty good, or maybe even better than you.
Yeah, much better than me.
Fair enough.
But that was another, you know, that's another Stephen Covey thing, is the hiring for your weaknesses.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one thing to read something like that, and it's another thing to really let go. You know, it's that letting go, that taking that step. But it's also learning how to work in sync, you know, and realize that you don't have to micromanage everything. But you have to spend the time to hire somebody good and realize that if they don't turn out to be compatible, to let them go and try again.
Yeah.
You know, and that's always been something that I've been afraid to do. When I was in my shop, you know, I'd run around my shop all the time, and I would micromanage every sewing and all the things they're doing, and make everybody nervous. And at one point, you know, I just had to say, okay, I've given them every possible bit of my knowledge And I just have to step back and let them do it. And then, you know, we'll just spot check things and we'll correct on when something happens. But we have to, I can't just hover over them. So I would say that that for me, that was a big step. And I'm going to consider that to be my success this week.
That's great. Well, my failure is all about not taking just a minute, a breath to think about something and take your time. This is back when I was working in the oil fields in Kansas. It was middle of summer, and we had a hole in what's called a saltwater injection well. It, when you bring up oil, you bring a lot of salt water up, so you have to pump it back down into the ground. And we had a hole in the casing, which is this the cement portion that, you know, drops all the way down, these kind of pipes that are cemented in and go down into the well site. And so I wasn't doing any of the work, but the guys came out, the crew for the workover came out, and they fixed the hole in the casing. I was out there all day. It's like an eight-hour day in the sun. Mostly I was just sitting there supervising as I did. But at the end of the day, they had finished, they left, and I had to backfill some of the places where they dug up and make sure that the wells have like a little wall around them of dirt so that if they break or something, the water doesn't flood out into the farmer's field. And I was tired and pissed because it was hot. And I just, if I just would have taken a breath, I wouldn't have swung the backhoe into the pipe and cracked all this PVC pipe off the side and just destroyed a bunch of work that needed to be redone. So I was there till about 3 a.m. fixing all of that back. And I would have been home for dinner had I just taken a minute. So my failure is just take a beat sometimes, especially when you're tired. Think about what you got to do. If you take those extra few moments, it'll probably save you a lot of time in the future. And I'm sure everybody's had that kind of problem in their life at least once.
So we have a, in pool, we have a famous player named Buddy Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddy Hall used to say, "This is not a foot race. It only takes you a few extra seconds to walk around the pool table all the way around it and analyze the layout, figure out what you want to do, and then get down and do it."
Mm-hmm.
And that has proven for us pool players to be invaluable advice, because a lot of us will just start shooting. We're too fast, and we'll make a mistake and won't get out and won't get through the rack. And the times that we do take that moment to walk around, we end up with better results. So I can fully echo that.
Yeah. It's a tough lesson to learn, but I think everybody's got to get it at some point. Well, that is it for this episode. You can find us at turtlesmith.com. Anything else to add?
I have nothing else. And all right, I mean man. It this time.
Fair enough. We'll see y'all next week.
All right. Y'all take care.